So, listen, I've been getting lots of good comments and feedback and emails and requests to chat and all sorts of things lately, much of which has made me really quite happy. However, I did want to address just a couple of things that have been coming in quite heavily lately, enough so for me to issue this global response. Number one, thank you for approving me for a $500,000 mortgage despite my credit, and how do you know? But I'm really not interested in the moment, despite your promise that the online application only takes a minute. Number two, no thank you, I would not like to keep her screaming all night long. Number three, no, it's very nice of you, but I'm not in the market for replica handbags, cheap tramadol, or the hottest tips on the China World Trade Market. So, good evening. It's Monday, April the 2nd, 2007, and it's Miette's Bedtime Story Podcast. Two Gentle People by Graham Greene. They sat on a bench in the Parc Monceau for a long time without speaking to one another. It was a hopeful day of early summer with a spray of white clouds lapping across the sky in front of a small breeze. At any moment the wind might drop and the sky become empty and entirely blue, but it was too late now. The sun would have set first. In younger people, it might have been a day for chance encounters, secret behind the long barrier of perambulators with only babies and nurses in sight. But they were both of them middle-aged, and neither was inclined to cherish an illusion of possessing a lost youth, though he was better-looking than he believed, with his silky old-world moustache like a badge of good behaviour, and she was prettier than the looking-glass ever told her. Modesty and disillusion gave them something in common. Though they were separated by 5 feet of green metal, they could have been a married couple who had grown to resemble each other. Pigeons, like old grey tennis balls, rolled unnoticed around their feet. They each occasionally looked at a watch, though never at one another. For both of them, this period of solitude and peace was limited. The man was tall and thin. He had what are called sensitive features. And the cliché fitted him. His face was comfortably, though handsomely, banal. There would be no ugly surprises when he spoke, for a man may be sensitive without imagination. He had carried with him an umbrella which suggested caution. In her case, one noticed first the long and lovely legs, as unsensual as those in a society portrait. From her expression, she found the summer day sad, yet she was reluctant to obey the command of her watch and go somewhere inside. They would never have spoken to each other if two teenaged louts had not passed by, one with a blaring radio slung over his shoulder and the other kicking out at the preoccupied pigeons. One of his kicks found a random mark, and on they went in a din of pop, leaving the pigeon lurching on the path. The man rose, grasping his umbrella like a riding whip. "Infernal young scoundrels!" he exclaimed, and the phrase sounded more Edwardian because of the faint American intonation. Henry James might surely have employed it. "The poor bird," the woman said. The bird struggled upon the gravel, scattering little stones. One wing hung slack, and a leg must have been broken too, for the pigeon swiveled round in circles, unable to rise. The other pigeons moved away with disinterest, searching the gravel for crumbs. "If you would look away for just a minute," the man said. He laid his umbrella down again and walked rapidly to the bird where it thrashed around. Then he picked it up, and quickly and expertly he wrung its neck. It was a kind of skill anyone of breeding ought to possess. He looked around for a refuse bin in which he tidily deposited the body. "There was nothing else to do," he remarked apologetically when he returned. I could not myself have done it, the woman said, carefully grammatical in a foreign tongue. Taking life is our privilege, he replied, with irony rather than pride. When he sat down, the distance between them had narrowed. They were able to speak freely about the weather and the first real day of summer. The last week had been unseasonably cold, and even today, he admired the way in which she spoke English and apologized for his own lack of French, but she reassured him it was no ingrained talent. She had been finished at an English school at Margate. At the seaside resort, isn't it? The sea always seemed very grey, she told him, and for a while they lapsed into separate silences. Then, perhaps, thinking of the dead pigeon, she asked him if he had been in the army. No, I was over 40 when the war came, he said. I served on a government mission in India. I became very fond of India. He began to describe to her Agra, Lucknow, the old city of Delhi. His eyes alight with memories. The new Delhi he did not like, built by a Britisher. Lut. No matter. It reminded him of Washington. Then you do not like Washington? To tell you the truth, he said, I am not very happy in my own country. You see, I like old things. I found myself more at home, can you believe it, in India, even with the British. And now in France I find it's the same. My grandfather was British consul in Nice. The Promenade des Anglais was very new then, she said. Yes, but it aged. What we Americans build never ages beautifully. The Chrysler Building, Hilton Hotels. Are you married? She asked. He hesitated a moment before replying. Yes. As though he wished to be quite accurate. He put out his hand and felt for his umbrella. It gave him confidence in the surprising situation of talking so openly to a stranger. I ought not to have asked you, she said, still careful with her grammar. Why not? He excused her awkwardly. I was interested in what you said. She gave him a little smile. The question came. It was imprévu. Are you married? He asked, but only to put her at ease, for he could see her ring. Yes. By this time they seemed to know a great deal about each other, and he felt it was churlish not to surrender his identity. He said, My name is Greaves, Henry C. Greaves. Mine is Marie-Claire Duval. What a lovely afternoon it has been, the man called Greaves said. But it gets a little cold when the sun sinks. They escape from each other, again with regret. A beautiful umbrella you have, said, and it was quite true. The gold band was distinguished, and even from a few feet away one could see there was a monogram engraved there, an H certainly, entwined perhaps with a C or a G. A present, he said, without pleasure. I admired so much the way you acted with the pigeon. As for me, I am lush. That, I am quite sure, is not true, he said kindly. Oh, it is. Only in the sense that we are all cowards about something. You are not, she said, remembering the pigeon with gratitude. Oh, yes, I am, he replied, in one whole area of life. It seemed on the brink of a personal revelation, and she clung to his coat-tail to pull him back. She literally clung to it, for lifting the edge of his jacket, she exclaimed, "You have been touching some wet paint!" The ruse succeeded. He became solicitous about her dress, but examining the bench, they both agreed the sauce was not there. "You've been painting on my staircase," he said. "You have a house here?" "No, an apartment. On the fourth floor." "With an ascenseur?" "Unfortunately not," he said sadly. "It's a very old house in the 17th." The door of his unknown life had opened a crack, and she wanted to give something of her own in return, but not too much. A brink would give her vertigo. She said, "My apartment is only too depressingly new, in the 8th. The door opens electrically without being touched, like in an airport." A strong current of revelation carried them along. He learned how she always bought her cheeses in the Place de la Madeleine. It was quite an expedition from her side of the 8th, near the Avenue Georges V, and once she had been rewarded by finding Tante Yvonne, the general's wife, at her elbow choosing a brie. He, on the other hand, bought his cheeses in the Rue de Tocqueville, only round the corner from his apartment. "You yourself?" "Yes, I do the marketing," he said in a voice suddenly abrupt. She said, "It is a little cold now. I think we should go." "You come to the park often?" "It is the first time." "What a strange coincidence," he said. "It's the first time for me too, even though I live quite close by. And I live so far away." They looked at one another with a certain awe, aware of the mysteries of Providence. He said, "I don't suppose you would be free to have a little dinner with me?" Excitement made her lapse into French. "Je suis libre, mais vous, votre femme..." "She's dining elsewhere," he said. "And your husband?" "He will not be back before 11. He suggested the Brasserie Lorraine, which was only a few minutes' walk away, and she was glad that he had not chosen something more chic or more flamboyant. The heavy bourgeois atmosphere of the brasserie gave her confidence, and, though she had small appetite herself, she was glad to watch the comfortable military progress down the ranks of the sauerkraut trolley. The menu, too, was long enough to give them time to readjust to the startling intimacy of dining together. When the order had been given, they both began to speak at once. "I never expected..." "It's funny the way things happen," he added, laying unintentionally a heavy inscribed monument over that conversation. "Tell me about your grandfather, the consul." "I never knew him," he said. "It was much more difficult to talk on a restaurant sofa than on a park bench." "Why did your father go to America?" "Spirit of adventure, perhaps," he said. "And I suppose it was the spirit of adventure which brought me back to live in Europe. America didn't mean Coca-Cola and Time Life when my father was young." "And you have found adventure? How stupid of me to ask. Of course, you married here." "I brought my wife with me," he said. "Poor patience."
"Poor?"
"She is fond of Coca-Cola."
"You can get it here," she said, this time with intentional stupidity.
"Yes." The wine waiter came, and he ordered a Sancerre. "If that will suit you."
"I know so little about wine," she said.
"I thought all French people..." "We leave it to our husbands," she said, and in his turn he felt an obscure hurt. The sofa was shared by a husband now as well as a wife, and for a while the sole meunière gave them an excuse not to talk, and yet silence was not a genuine escape. In the silence the two ghosts would have been
more firmly planted if the woman had not found the courage to speak.
"Have you any children?" she asked.
"No." "Have you?"
"No."
"Are you sorry?"
She said, "I suppose one is always sorry to have missed something."
"I'm glad, at least, that I did not miss the Parc Monceau today."
"Yes, I am glad too."
The silence after that was a comfortable silence. The two ghosts went away and left them alone. Once their fingers touched over the sugar caster, they had chosen strawberries. Neither of them had any desire for further questions. They seemed to know each other more completely than they knew anyone else. It was like a happy marriage. The stage of discovery was over. They had passed the test of jealousy, and now they were tranquil in their middle age. Time and death remained the only enemies, and coffee was like the warning of old age. After that, it was necessary to hold sadness at bay with a brandy, though not successfully. It was as though they had experienced a lifetime which was measured as with butterflies in hours. He remarked of the passing head waiter, "He looks like an undertaker."
"Yes," she said. So he paid the bill and they went outside. It was a death agony. They were too gentle to resist for long. He asked, "Can I see you home?"
"I would rather not, really not. You live so close."
"We could have another drink on the terrace," he suggested with a half-sad heart.
"It would do nothing more for us," she said. "The evening was perfect. Tu es vraiment gentil." She noticed too late that she had used two, and she hoped his French was bad enough for him not to have noticed. They did not exchange addresses or telephone numbers, for neither of them dared to suggest it. The hour had come too late in both their lives. He found her a taxi, and she drove away towards the great illuminated arc. And he walked home by the Rue Geoffroy, slowly. What is cowardice in the young is wisdom in the old. But all the same, one can be ashamed of wisdom. Marie Claire walked through the opening doors and thought, as she always did, of airports and escapes. On the sixth floor, she let herself into the flat. An abstract painting in cruel tones of scarlet and yellow faced the door and treated her like a stranger. She went straight to her room as softly as possible, locked the door, and sat down on her single bed. Through the wall she could hear her husband's voice and laugh. She wondered who was with him tonight, Tony or François. François had painted the abstract picture, and Tony, who danced in ballet, always claimed, especially before strangers, to have modelled for the little stone phallus with painted eyes that had a place of honour in the living room. She began to undress. With a voice next door, spinning its web, images of the bench in the Parc Monceau returned, and of the sauerkraut trolley in the Brasserie Lorraine. If he had heard her come in, her husband would soon proceed to action. It excited him to know that she was a witness. The voice said, "Pierre, Pierre," reproachfully. Pierre was a new name to her. She spread her fingers on the dressing table to take off her rings, and she thought of the sugar caster for the strawberries. But at the sound of the little yelps and giggles from next door, the sugar caster turned into the phallus with painted eyes. She lay down and screwed beads of wax into her ears, and she shut her eyes and thought how different things might have been if 15 years ago she had sat on a bench in the Parc Monceau, watching a man with pity killing a pigeon. "I can smell a woman on you," Patience Greaves said with pleasure, sitting up against two pillows. The top pillow was punctured with brown cigarette burns. "Oh, no, no, you can't. It's your imagination, dear. You said you would be home by 10. It's only 9:20 now. You've been up in the Rue de Douai, haven't you, in one of those bars looking for a fee? I sat in the Parc Monceau, and then I had dinner at the Brasserie Lorraine. Can I give you your drops? You want me to sleep now, so I won't expect anything. That's it, isn't it? You're too old now to do it twice." He mixed the drops from the carafe of water on the table between the twin beds. Anything he might say would be wrong when Patience was in a mood like this. Poor Patience, he thought, holding out the drops toward the face crowned with red curls. How she misses America. She will never believe that the Coca-Cola tastes the same here. Luckily, this would not be one of their worst nights, for she drank from the glass without further argument, while he sat beside her and remembered the street outside the Brasserie, and how, by accident, he was sure he had been called too. "What are you thinking?" Patience asked. "Are you still in the Rue de Douai?" "I was only thinking that things might have been different," he said. It was the biggest protest he had ever allowed himself to make against the condition of life.